Welcome to the Ethics Experts, where we're elevating ethics and compliance and HR to the strategic level it's supposed to be.
Well, we're talking about this short-term, long-term thinking, which has turned into an extreme dichotomy across sort of people's approach to business. And I think it gets exacerbated at the public company level, where they're managing from quarter to quarter earnings, and they have to give these analysts a picture of, hey, I'm going to make, you know, 35 cents per share next you know, month. And then there's all this sort of accounting tricks and stuff like that to smooth those earnings and manage those earnings so that they hit that accurate thing. And what that ends up doing is taking your eye off of what the true mission of the organization is. And that gets superseded by, I got to hit next quarter. So what you're actually saying, I think, is that it's not about me making more money this quarter. It's about me being around for the next 100 years or something. And right. when your viewpoint shifts from this, like this myopic view that really has only room for one thing, when that's a stack of coins, to a longer term timeline, then you can make those sort of sometimes, you know, contrary decisions or whatever, where you say, okay, I got to shift over here and I got to take care of these assets. I got to pour some more money, so to speak, into these assets being my people, if I want not only the company to be around on the back end, but for my folks to come back when we emerge from this thing energized and knowing that, hey, the culture that we've built and the values that we built are actually real, and they can hang their hat on those and they can count on those things. And that's how an organization, I think, is going to be able to emerge from this, you know, in a stronger position.
Yeah, I don't think I could ever run anything that was driven, that was publicly traded. Not that that opportunity would ever come about, but it, I just.
And because of the beard?
that and the 11 quarter to quarter thing. I think some can do it. I think some can say to shareholders for the moment, dividends and stock price are going to be second to taking care of the people right now. There are people who can actually turn that message into an asset or a benefit. Sure. It's hard because shareholders are pretty ruthless. It's pretty funny. Here's another observation I got, is that everybody talks about how terrible big business is and how terrible big companies, how terrible it is to, you know, live quarter to quarter and all that. And then when they go look at their investments, and they got big money in a certain company, and that company isn't being ruthless enough, and focused on the stock price, they flip. Now they're all they become the problem. There are people who literally complain about both things. Why aren't you being more ruthless and making my stock price go up? And then why aren't you being a civil human being in a situation like this? You got to be able to outsmart it. You got to save money. You got to put money away for tough times. You got to be able to overlook the pressures from shareholders, particularly big shareholders. But ultimately, I think you're seeing some companies going back private just to get away from this nightmare we've created.
Yeah, well, that, I think it's one of those unintended consequences where, again, there's a whole, you know, slew of unintended incentives that folks are actually responding to, because the guy running the company has all these stock options that are only going to vest if the stock continues to go up, and it's only going to go up, to your point, if it is the expected return is what, you know, the actual return is in line with the expected return, and that's going to be all built by the analysts and what they think is going to happen, and does that actually happen, and all these other things end up sort of superseding what's going on. And when that company goes back private, at least in theory, some of those unintended consequences or externalities can kind of be removed, but sometimes they fall back into the same thing. Like the private equity firm has to go and raise their next fund or
whatever those things are. That's a whole nother world investors, you know, that private equity and all that. But think about where this conversation has gone. This is all about integrity, right? Aligning your values, morals, principles, what you believe to be true, to your actions and your words. There's all these things can interfere with it. Mm-hmm. So we're just about to launch any day now, the first couple podcasts, but I'm doing a podcast called Discovering Integrity with a woman named Andra Popa, who is a longtime, very, very creative, interesting compliance professional, comes at our world from a very different angle, very creative angle. And we're going to talk about integrity. And you think about this, it's like a virus almost, you know, in the sense that integrity or the lack of it can infect any or many, many aspects of life. And so, again, I will constantly bring people back to study conflicts of interest, study bias, study critical thinking, so that when you say something, you know that it's true, and you won't give people the impression that you lack integrity because you didn't think through something before you said it and ended up being wrong, and now they think you lack integrity. The basics, I'm going to come back to the basics. It probably ought to be a summary of every show is, okay, we wandered off into some really interesting stuff, but let's get back to how you and I can change today or tomorrow or improve by tools. And like there's at the end of every chapter, there's some kind of lesson plan. Actionable steps that will get us to have more integrity. That's what I want everybody to think about. These other discussions are really fascinating. The finger pointing, Ariely's a millionaire and I'm not. And there's a lot to be gained from going in this finger pointing, theoretical, academic.
Yeah, but it turns into navel gazing and it's not actually doing anything at some level, unless it's actually changing behaviors or perspectives that are, you know, exhibited in the real world.
That may be ultimately why I wrote the book, is that for 24 years, roughly, since I started with Debbie Trochels and Brent Saunders, SECE or HECA, which eventually turned into an international all-industry organization, is that the navel gazing and the philosophical, you know, get by a pulpit and tell everybody to do the right thing was not effective, in my opinion. And so in my final act, I rebelled against all of the navel gazers, the pointer sisters, the finger pointers. I said, here's something that I think has substance and actionable steps. I can feel my retirement side of me coming out here, getting a little bit more ornery or in people's, because that's just going to irritate a whole lot of people. And I'm kind of like, don't call me.
Don't call me. Hit me on LinkedIn. So I loved, I want to come back to this thing. You were talking about being like manic about, you know, you got to be a business person and you have to recognize the people and you have to be able to create, you have to be able to hold both of those things. And that's a hard thing to do. It's harder to hold two things than it is to hold one thing.
Yep.
It's harder to keep that sort of balancing game going. And you talked about something else that I think is what could maybe, you know, if you want to get down to like an actionable tip, is something that you can embed into your culture for somebody listening. That I think you've kind of talked about and referenced a couple of times. And this is this idea of like an idea meritocracy, where you're like, listen, this right. is my idea. We can have like a civil discourse about this. We can have a civil debate about this. If I'm wrong, I'm open to being wrong. Get some more people and convince me. This is not, you know, me slamming a gavel down and telling you to keep your head down and don't meet my eyes, because how dare you? That type of thing, right?
Right.
Why is that so hard for people to, why is that idea meritocracy so hard to embed on your team? And how does sort of intellectual honesty or dishonesty relate to this in terms of integrity?
Oh, there's so many thoughts running through my head. One of them is odd, that you've got to be pretty confident. You got to have a pretty gigantic ego to say, argue with me, debate with me, tell me I'm wrong. I'm going to listen for long enough to make sure I know what you're talking about. And then I'm either going to agree or I'm going to run your derriere over, because you may not understand it, but what you want to do is going to interfere with the plan, the success. Another way to answer your question might be is to hold those both things true. You got to be such an effective business person. See, you can be a late, you could be a less experienced business person and be successful if you're just ruthless and right. just turn over and take advantage of people, and you can make your net. Now, if you're a real mad skilled business person, then you understand better than most what will sell and what won't sell and how to provide good customer service and how to market. Oh my gosh, how to market like a madman. You kind of got that. Then I have extra money and time to do both. So kind of good business people kind of have to take advantage of people. Really super smart, good business people with great judgment and decision making can make money, grow, get respect, and take care of the people. And so to me, I don't know. This is all easy to say. It's just tough to do. I don't know. What do you think?
What was the question? No, I'm kidding. I think it is, I think it's like the most important thing to do. I think it maybe starts with a mindset thing, and it starts with that sort of longer term view. And I think it takes some confidence to have this longer term view and to really, right. really lean on this belief that like there's a universal law of reaping and sowing. So you don't plant a bunch of corn and think that you're going to get an orange grove. Like if you're planting corn, you're going to get corn. And so I think if you do the right things, whatever goodness you want is going to come. It might not come today. It might not come next year, but it's going to come at some point. And again, maybe this is just easier to say than to do, but if you can afford sort of quote unquote to have that kind of longer term view, then you can be more patient with people. Then you don't bring that sort of anxiety into every single discussion. And, you know, we've talked about this a little bit. Like if you see a mosaic on the wall, you know, a big mural and it's a mosaic and it's a million different tiles. Not every tile is going to be perfect. Some are going to be misshapen and some are going to be miscolored. But when you step back, you can see this beautiful picture. I think when you have that longer term view and you're not so myopic zoomed in on just this little thing, then there's room for those tiles to be mistaken, misshapen or whatever. And I think if you can bring that to your team and let them see that, like, listen, you hit one out of three pitches, you're a Hall of Famer. Like you're not going to get them all right. And you can kind of hold things a little bit more loosely. And then you can sort of start to, you know, I think take yourself a little less seriously. Cause I don't think even these, like, you know, these people with these massive egos, who you can't even tell them anything is wrong. Like if you had just an intellectually honest conversation with them and you said, you don't think you're perfect, right? It would say, no, of course I'm not perfect. But like, yet they act that way. I mean, the other side of that is like, okay, well then if you're not perfect, then you're wrong sometimes. And if you're wrong sometimes, then you might be wrong this time. And you need to bring some intellectual honesty to this debate or to this thing to say, hey, maybe I haven't considered this thing or this other thing. And maybe that's kind of rooted in that critical thinking stuff you were talking about. But I think it's kind of a mindset, you know, I guess if I could boil down everything I just said, I think it's a mindset thing and it's a timeline perspective. Like, you know, what game are you playing? Are you trying to win this particular at bat? Or are you trying to win the 9-inning game? You know,
the one thing I would emphasize is that if you want to be considered that person who really puts the people up there, along with I got to keep the company running, you just got to have mad business skills. Here's something I didn't tell too many people as I went along the way, I kind of consider myself a benevolent dictator, which is not, I don't advise people to say that. I don't advise people to do it that way. It has very negative connotations. By the way, I told one person this who didn't particularly care for, I didn't do all the stuff she wanted me to do. It wasn't an employee. And she said, well, you got the dictator part right. And so basically what I mean by that is I would say, okay, let's talk. Okay, enough with the talking. Here's where we're going. Everybody can, every, if you have 25 people on staff and every, and you say everybody can decide where we're going, you're screwed.
Right.
You got to go one way. Eventually, whether you, people want to admit it or not, but good leaders have to be a bit of a dictator and say, we all have to go, generally speaking, in one direction. We have to have one mission and so on and so forth. And I have to make tough calls. Here's what I also tell the people at the end of the year. When we had a big net and we contributed to the reserve and we grew member-wise or count-wise, numbers went up, reputation went up, we accomplished a lot of cool stuff. I would, once a year, pretty much, I would tell them, okay, now you remember all that stuff that we had to do throughout the year that I didn't agree, you didn't agree with, or that made you mad, or I wouldn't take that idea, or we had to do things a certain way. This is what it's all about. Because now you feel good. You have increased your reputation, you have increased the reserve, you've increased the growth, you're proud of what you've done, you're a respected organization. Try and remember this throughout the course of the year when things don't necessarily go your way. And so that's kind of how I tried to listen to everybody, take care of the people, but not to the degree where I agreed with so much that we ended up all losing our jobs because the company went under.
Yeah, and I think that's an important piece to sort of close that feedback loop and just remind people that, hey, you know, we had a tough year or whatever, or we had a bunch of debate this year and everything that you wanted probably didn't happen, but we still won the game, right? Like, not every time you line up for the snap is every guy agreeing with the play that's being called. But you can still win the game in spite of that.
People fail. You know, the guy didn't make the block. And this quarterback got hurt. And that guy feels terrible. And people screw up throughout the course of the year. Usually smaller things. And you got to let all that go.
Right.
You know, you got to, we win the game. I'll tell you a funny story. So we would play soccer. We have four girls, and they played soccer when they were really young. And they, oh my gosh, sports parents are just crazy. And they would just scream, you know, a handful of them, not all.
Right.
And kick the ball, kick the ball, kick the ball, pass the ball. Screaming, and I finally just yelled out to the world, win the game. And it was kind of like, let's get to the point here.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I just what are we doing here? How stupid it was to yell at them to kick the ball. I don't know.
Yeah, there was a boxing match a couple of months ago, and you know, they show the guys in the corner. And, you know, you can hear how they're pep talking to the guy. And the coach was telling this poor guy who was just getting, like, pummeled. He's like, knock him out, man. Just knock him out. It's that kind of thing. It's like an insane thing. Of course he's trying to knock him out. He's trying to win the fight. I love that. I love that. I love that picture. Just win the game. I wanted to ask you this question. So we are all subject to these biases and these cognitive errors. Right? That's our like natural state, right? We have this confirmation bias. We have these different things. And these are all, you know, I think one of your Royisms was like confirmation bias is kryptonite to integrity or something, right?
Exactly. Thank you. It's my favorite one.
Oh, good. Okay. I like that one too. So what do we do? So, I mean, you know, maybe I'm answering my own question. Like, where is our line for like responsibility against these biases? And how do we, with certainty or high certainty or high enough certainty, battle against them in the decision-making process, whether it's an integrity-based one or it's just a problem-solving one?
Okay, so there's a guy named Charles Lord. I think I got his name right. I referred to a few researchers throughout the book, but this one researcher had a control group where he told nothing to and then had him look at abortion. And they would looked at the research and the people who were pro-abortion just found what they wanted to find. And people were anti-abortion and said, all this same research proves my point. which can't be right. You know, it's all the research they were shown proves complete opposite. That is the ultimate epitome of confirmation bias. And so then he did another one where he told one group nothing, the same thing really. And then he told another group, here's what biases are, don't have them. Here's what confirmation bias is, don't do this. They had them do it again, and they all still did the same thing. In other words, being aware of bias, sadly, which is what I'd like the answer to be that easy. You'll just read my book, read chapter whatever right. on bias, and your life will be good. Well, that turns out that's nonsense. And again, I'm trying to take it from the babblers who get up at a podium and say, don't be biased, and didn't bother to study integrity enough to know that that has been proven not to work. Then what he did was he said, decide what you want. Against abortion, for abortion, and then study the opposite. Consider the opposite. Prove yourself wrong. And then that's when people were able to overcome bias. People who do investigations, Jerry Zak told me about this, but he's a bias expert. I interviewed him for that chapter. He does a lot of presentations and education on bias. He's a certified fraud examiner. He knows how to investigate. Good investigators do this. They come to their conclusion, and before they tell their answer, they go and say, okay, now I'm going to do my best to prove myself wrong.
Right.
Another way to look at it, this is the way I looked at it, is how could I fail it? How could I embarrass myself? I'm about to go forward with something, whatever it is. I don't want to be wrong. I'm going to go try and prove myself wrong, say all the things that other people are going to say about what I'm about to do so that I correct for that mistake and come forward with a better plan. But you gotta doubt yourself. You gotta disprove yourself. If you go through that exercise, the answer you come up with will be solid.
Right. So
Charles Lord proved that considering the opposite, come to your answer, try and prove yourself wrong, is the only way he could get a sample group of people to overcome bias.
It's a, it's kind of like, well, what other reasonable explanations could there be? And then you kind of run down that path and say, well, like, that's actually not reasonable because of X, Y, or Z, and then so forth. And you can start cutting those things away. I think another kind of tool that can help with this kind of bias thing is kind of a way to fight against this binary thinking that we have. We think something is definitely this or it's definitely that, right? And I read this book called Thinking in Bets, and it really helped to underscore this sort of expected value type of thinking. And so just forcing someone to say, like, what are the odds, you know, how certain are you that you're right? Kind of put some kind of a confidence interval around something.
Right.
I mean, when are you actually 100%? There's like maybe two things that you can be 100% about. Most of the other things are some varying degree, and you're saying, you know, I'm kind of 80% on this, and that's fine. That's just how kind of life works. But incorporating that type of thinking, I think, helps us just – it's another kind of tool to fight against these biases before we just jump to this conclusion and just move on to the next thing, which I think we all have some tendency to do at some level.
It's oddly connected to confidence. The more confidence that you might have, the more willing you are to doubt yourself, you know, to say, I'm okay.
Counterintuitive. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm okay with who I am. I'm okay with being wrong. I'm going to go forward to this business action or this decision or this whatever, and I'm going to play devil's advocate on myself. Actually, another way to do this is to have, I'm going to coin a phrase stolen from some paper I heard about from Richard Bistrong from Harvard. They didn't use this word, but that's where I got the idea, integrity partner.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so let's say you're about to do something and maybe there isn't a lot of good available data or there isn't a good way to test your hypothesis or question yourself to make sure you're not, you know, that you've overcome your bias and you're as right can be, is I just love calling experts. It's a part of critical thinking. Critical thinking is simply gathering facts and checking with experts. You got to know what an expert is, by the way, and it's a pretty simple definition. Somebody has done for 20 or 30 years what you're about to do for the first time. And I would inevitably, you know, luckily, because I had so many contacts being a part of a 20,000 member professional association, have 18 rocket science board members, I often didn't have to go past the board. I would just call a board member. You do this for 20 years. I'm about to do this. What could I go wrong? And quite often, due to personality, my personality, whatever, they would just say, well, just tweak this one thing and it'll go over a little better, right? You know, don't
soften this up or say this way or something.
Yes. Yeah. You're generally okay here, but if you present this better, or if you just leave this one piece out, that really isn't consequential. There are times when they would just say, you're barking up the wrong tree, you know, don't do it. But more often your integrity, so I would have integrity advisors, not one, but integrity advisor to every aspect of your life. And somebody's going to fill three or four aspects of your life, but the more, this is why networking is so important.
Right.
LinkedIn, go crazy on LinkedIn. Build your network. Study your people. Read their posts. Join a professional association. Go to conferences. Build your network, because I got taught this. I dedicated the first book in part to my mentor, Mark Duttman, who I was a compliance officer. I worked for him at Mayo, and then he went to the University of Wisconsin. I followed him there to be his compliance officer. He would get his act together about making a big decision. Then he would call somebody up who did what he's about to do 20 times, as opposed to what he had done never.
Right.
And he'd say, okay, I know what I'm talking about enough to ask you this question, but I have no idea whether I'm right. So you've done it 20 times, or you've done it 20 years. What would you do, or what did you do? It was just, it's so cheap. It's so easy. And people rarely do it. Man, I don't know how much I wandered off from your binary thinking.
No, this actually went right into the next thing I wanted to talk about. I mean, it's kind of this mentor piece. It's kind of this accountability partner thing. It's kind of about, really, it's about decision making. And there's no, you know, I like to say that there's no room with more groupthink in it than a room with one person in it. You know, convince yourself of anything, you know what I mean? So just having to go to, you know, my brother's really good at this, and we have a good sort of devil's advocacy culture. We might actually agree on something, and he's good at hopping on the other side and just sort of taking the other sort
why
of-
Why not?
Yeah, why not? Why not beat it up, and why not
you're
actually-
You're gonna get it one way or another. You're gonna get it eventually. Practice. At a minimum, you're getting practice answering questions. Sorry to interrupt.
No. I think that's exactly the point. And it lets you, again, it gets back to that, you know, okay, I can increase my confidence interval on whether this is a good decision by bouncing it off of you, or bouncing it off of my brother, or bouncing it off of some expert who might ask a question that I hadn't thought of, or no, you know, that's why you take your car to a mechanic before you buy it. Because yep. they know what to look, and they know kind of, you know, something that you probably don't know. But it's just, it's astounding how, to your point, how people don't utilize this kind of free service that's part of their network.
So it would drive me insane. I would have employees who I'd say, why didn't you call an expert? You're doing this for the first time. The response would be, I'm being paid to do this. I'm being paid to think. This is my responsibility. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, that's some wonderful stuff applied to the right thing, to have all that sense of responsibility. But to exclude consulting others because you feel that you'll be like cheating. So another way to describe it is, if you go to somebody and say, you know, should you go to a foot doctor for brain surgery? They go, no. Or you're about to invest $100,000. Should you talk to anybody? I'm not thinking of that. There's certain things where people say, of course I would check with an expert. And then particularly in business,
right?
They're about to do some product for the first time, or project or system, or buy a piece of software, and they will consult no one. And you go to them and ask them why, and they've got this beautiful explanation for them, but for you, it's like, oh my gosh, I'm sorry, wrong answer.
Yeah, and what do you think that's rooted in? Do you think it's an ego thing? Do you think it's a cultural thing?
All that, pick your, they got it all, but generally, sadly, unfortunately, they mean well.
Yeah, right, and they might think it's an integrity thing, maybe. Well, I can't use this guy's idea. You're paying me for these ideas or something. I don't know.
It's a mean well, good person doing a relatively not so good thing of not consulting experts. It's like we get into this thing right now, and it gets back to why I wrote the book, Politics and Social Issues. We've lost our minds. We're not gathering facts. We got too many opinions. We're confirmation bias, where I just go get an article to prove a selective search.
Right.
You know, why is it good to have this thing and not a general search into the pros and cons? People don't have a healthy respect for fact gathering and expert opinion. And here's the good news, man, because so few people do that. If you've got that respect for expert opinion, get a network, call the right person with all the experience, check facts, do things like play devil's advocate. If you've got that stuff, you're going to pick a business, pick an industry. You're going to crush it, because so many people you're competing against don't do it. You're going to be able to get all the market share you want.
Yeah, I think that's it's a huge point. And I think it also works, you know, it works on the macro level if you're running a company or you're kind of getting into a new industry. And it also works at the micro level if you're just running a small team or you have five people beneath you that you're overseeing. Just to ask those questions. And I think what it ends up doing, a couple of things. One, it lets you accelerate and differentiate. It allows you to get better ideas into your world. And it also, to the extent that you're able to present that process to the rest of your team, it lowers the sort of ego of the entire team and allows that idea meritocracy to start to fill in there. So then that team can be sort of this, you know, perpetual motion machine of better ideas.
I'll tell you what, don't make the mistake I did. I didn't have this very conversation with my staff clearly enough, often enough. I should have pulled everybody together. I hated meetings. I only did about a dozen meetings. I mean, I don't know, a couple meetings a year. They would pull people together for some event, and I would say a few words beforehand. But I would have called an all-staff meeting had I had my head on straight and told them that. We're not the idea people. We're the go find the ideas. Or we're not the process people. We're about to go find the best process people. We're smart. We're good. But our job here is to go get the expert ideas. I want to get back to this critical thinking. I put a whole chapter on it. And I did 8 video interviews. The first one was just released with a company called Compliance Wave, a guy named Joel Rogers. And I interviewed him for the chapter on being genuine, because he's such an honest, genuine individual. What you see is what you get there. Very much like yourself, sir. And it's something you should be proud of. But this, he literally put a question mark on the chapter of critical thinking. Why is this in a book on integrity? And I love Joel to death, but it was a head slapper. A forehead smacker.
Yeah.
I said, think about it. If you don't do critical thinking, if you don't talk to experts, if you don't gather all the facts, you're going to say something wrong. Now, you may think I just made a mistake, but people looking on said, you didn't tell the truth. You don't have integrity. What you told me and what I based an action or a decision I then went on to have, and I told other people this thing that wasn't, you screwed me. You don't have integrity. Of course you've got to do critical thinking. You have to make sure what you're saying is true. You got to ask the experts. You got to search for the facts. maybe do that a little bit devil's advocate thing. I've got that in the bias chapter, not in the critical thinking chapter. But critical thinking is essential for integrity. And here it is. I should not be surprised, right? I wrote a book about a gooey subject that everybody else does from podium preaching and finger pointing and fables. Mm-hmm. So I write one that's just the opposite. Practical, actionable steps, lesson plans, stuff like that, albeit a small book, it's somewhat helpful to this very big complex thing. And of course people are going to look at it and go, well, that's not how to do it. We've always done it this way. And I'm like, well, whatever you've done in the past, I'm sorry, it's not working. Settlements in major corporations are off the biggest they've ever been. I personally believe our cultural integrity with regard to politics and social issues couldn't be more in the toilet.
Right.
Phrase I wouldn't have used prior to retirement, probably. But you're getting the unfettered
reading. We're seeing the real road.
People should fear this. I have a little bit of hesitancy to say what I really think for a number of reasons, one of which people are still going to always associate me with SCCE, and I never want to hurt them. But there is greater risk of me saying stuff that could be problematic because, like I said, if you want to be true to yourself, if you want to have solid integrity, a key thing is you got to let go from what people want you to say. I mean, be civil, be a good. One more thing about that, by the way, whenever I write about, there's a chapter on civil debate and telling, I want people to understand how to do it well. I tell people, be genuine, be yourself. And they say, oh my gosh, thank you so much. Everybody tells me I'm a jerk. They'll do the post. I've done a few posts on being truthful and all this sort of thing. And, well, thank you, Roy, for confirming that I'm okay because everybody tells me I'm a jerk. And I said, no. Don't use my thing here about telling the truth as an excuse to be a jerk. I didn't say, it's okay to be a jerk.
Right.
You can be truthful, which I hope to be in my retirement, more truthful, but still be civil about it. And by the way, have you studied civil debate much?
I haven't, no.
There's some stuff you got to look. Have you ever heard of this is another thing I shouldn't bring up because it's just going to alienate people. But have you ever heard of a thing called the intellectual dark web?
I think I have. This is basically, it's basically the confirmation bias web.
It could be. I think I heard a little bit about that. But basically, there's some people like Eric Weinstein. I'm gonna butcher his name. Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson.
Yes.
They're people from all different political and social views. Democrats, Republicans, this is a mistake people make. They think it's one side or the other, and whatever side you think they're on, then you hate them. Don't do that. I saw seven of them up on the panel, and they've been told that they were one side or the other, and they think they're all Republicans, and they hate them. And Weinstein, it's Eric and his brother, were on this panel, and they said, we're both Democrats. And I believe it was Eric coined the phrase intellectual dark web. Please, if anybody goes in to study these people, please set aside your politics and your social issues for a moment and watch just one thing, how they debate. And by the way, why is civil debate an important part of integrity? Truth and honesty are probably the only two morals or values or principles that I would agree to that have to be on your list of integrity, to have integrity. There's no compromising. And if you want to get to the truth, you have to debate, you have to discuss, you have to learn. And these guys do it better than anybody at a time when everybody's shouting each other down.
Yeah, we're in this realm where, to your point, if the tweet is from a Democrat and you're a Republican, or if it's tweets from a Republican and you're a Democrat, they could be saying the most basic thing, that the tree is green or the sky is blue, and you
you're gonna get crucified.
Yeah, you must agree, or you must disagree, or you're not a real Republican, or you're not a real Democrat. And I know some of those names that you talked about, and I understand what you're talking about. A lot of those guys say things, again, the idea should stand on its own regardless of who's saying it. The truth of the statement is going to be true or not, depending on, irrespective of who says it, right?
Hate the idea. Don't hate the person or the debate or their attempt to try and describe why they think the way they do. Disagree with capital punishment if you want, or agree with it. But embrace the civil debate of it. And it, there is a video of Sam Harris and Jordan Peterson, and they did a 3-hour debate with a moderator. And the first thing they did was Jordan described Sam's views on religion and said, Sam, I'm going to describe to you your position before we debate, so you know I have listened. And then you correct me until I get it right. When Jordan was done describing Sam's position, which Jordan was about 180 degrees in disagreement with,
right,
Sam said, you could write my next book.
Right.
Then Sam described Jordan's position on religion, and Jordan said, I've got nothing. That's close enough. And then they debated a polarizing issue for 3 hours, civilly and beautifully. If you dislike this thing you just described about a tweet made by a person who's in a group that everything they say you hate and disagree with, regardless of the, don't study, don't do any critical thing, don't fact check, don't do nothing, just hate it. Disagree with it because they're a part of a group you don't like. If you don't like that, go find the Jordan Peterson, Sam Harris debates. It was the first one they did. It was about 3 hours long, and watch the first part of it is all you got to do. And now you're not just talking about this. By the way, the vague crowd would just say, listen, you should listen. The guys who are more into prove it, is do what they did. Prove you listened.
Right.
Describe their position.
Yeah, and you can't do that unless you actually understand the position. And so listening, understand. I can sit through a podcast, or I can sit through a thing, and all the words are sort of flowing into my ears. That's technically listening. But until you can articulate it back without logical fallacies and ad hominem attacks, which is what to do, then you don't really understand it. And, you know, frankly, look, Jordan Peterson did not think he was going to convince him of the other position, nor did the other guy think he was going to convince Jordan Peterson to come on his side. But the point is that forum, which is actually a very interesting debate, was really about exploring these well-articulated positions that, again, were not sort of, you know, head in the sand positions. They were positions in the context of these other arguments to better understand the sort of the facets and the shapes of those positions, which we like don't have any time for. We're flipping through our feed. We're looking for a tweet. We're getting that dopamine drip in our brain from something that really resonates with us. And we're flipping past the things that create that dissonance for our position, because we all have this kind of internal desire to remain, to be sort of like logically consistent or something like that. But it ends up just feeding us into these logical sort of fallacy areas that there's no room for that civil debate, which is extremely destructive.
So something that people really should hang on to that you said is they're not probably going to change their position. People make gigantic changes, 180 degree flips, but it's super rare. What happens during civil debate is that Jordan or Sam, on polar opposite positions will make a point. The other person will beat it up. And Jordan will say, oh, you're right. I didn't explain that right. Let me make my case better. So they, and sometimes, you know, your position, albeit 180 degrees different, is made up of a whole bunch of smaller elements. Right. And you may give up a piece of your position, may not give up the primary position, but you give up a, oh yeah, you're right. I shouldn't say that. That's wrong to say. Or I should say it better. I believe it still, even though you disagree with me, but I see how the way I describe, you know, these guys are getting smarter. They're getting to the truth. Men and women and of the intellectual dark web, which once again, if you go look at this and you read about it, political fanatics have made it
political,
and it's not. I mean, they do discuss politics, I'm sure, but the intellectual dark web is the antithesis to what's happening on social media and this hate and polarized environment. If you hate what's going on, go study these guys. I actually had it in the book, but it got pulled out because, well, wait a minute. I don't think I ever said the words. I can't remember. The book got edited a lot, and they kind of thought that this would be upsetting to people to talk about, which is kind of a shame.
Is interesting, but it's also interesting. It also speaks to this sort of culture that we're in right now, where just if you and I disagree on a particular issue or a particular social perspective or something, then I must be a really bad person. It's a bizarre view.
I wrote this book with a woman named Karen Kenny, who has edited 200 books and written 200 books roughly. She is a genius. She saved me, literally. But we are all in great risk of me writing another book, because if I do now that I don't work there, it won't be with Karen probably. I suppose I could subcontract her with her, but if I ever wrote a book without a guiding person like that, I could be in, God help us all, we're in trouble, because I would not leave out stuff that will make people mad.
Maybe that's what the world needs, Roy. Maybe now's the time to unleash you for real. You know what? You get a gnome de plume and you write whatever you want.
I could. And I still wouldn't do it without a good book editor, but it would be absolutely a treat to say, you know, look, this time I will listen all I can. I will read, you know, she made me fact check and research. There's a lot of incredible value, but there's going to be some stuff I'm going to put in the book that you're not going to like. And you're going to tell me it's going to make people mad, and then I'm going to have to leave it in.
Yeah, and it's just, it's too bad that that's kind of where we're at. I don't know if there's been other points in recorded history where it's been like this. I just don't know. I think I have this like romantic view of like ancient Greece, where guys would just kind of like sit around under a tree and just sort of just debate and so forth. But this can't be the first time that it's that this level of sort of this, you know, it gets so visceral or something. I don't know.
I got to tell you about the Age of Reason. You know what? You've heard of the Age of Reason? Okay. So I'm buzzing along in this book, and I go, you know what I'm advocating for? Sounds like something I heard of called the Age of Reason. That's all I knew about it. The three words, Age of Reason. I went and looked it up. You know, I read the definition simply. For 100-year period, you weren't thrown in jail for saying the earth was round, or I think the earth revolves around the sun as opposed to the other way. It was 100-year period where we essentially had civil debate and unbelievable mathematical, astronomical, and many other fields of industry or thought or study where there was huge advancements.
Right.
Age of Reason, all it was all this crap we got right now was shut down.
Right.
And
sort of the opposite of what we're living in now, you're saying.
So I think you're right to say that have a little bit of a Pollyannish view. Now there are horrible periods of age of, I call the period we're in right now, the age of unreason.
Right.
We've always been in a state of flux. The pendulum swings back and forth. My belief is that this thing that I really wrote the book about is this age of unreason, and please using integrity, let's get out of it. I think the pendulum on its way back. I think this will lead to a second age of reason. And I say that a little tongue in cheek, because I obviously don't know the future. I'm only guessing. But I think we're going to come to our senses here, and we're going to look at all these college campuses with shutting speakers down and telling people they can't talk. Of all the places
I know
in the world. And somehow it's going to be a head smacking moment for everybody where we go back to civil debate.
Yeah, maybe that's a whole podcast about this topic, because, you know, this place, college, where ideas are supposed to form and they're supposed to be, you know, the home of civil debate and the exploration of different perspectives and so forth. To your point, this pendulum has swung to such a degree where you can't say certain things, and, you know, it's just it's an insane.
Let me be wrong. Let me say something that you with more experience say, well, that you're close, Roy, but you don't know this fact. Add this fact in, change what you said just a little bit. You're not undoing everything, and now you're going to be smarter. It's like this: if we sit here and just poo-poo everything somebody else says because they're not in my group, it's hard to get better. I say I have an experience and a thought, an idea that's right. You have an idea that a thought and experience is right. There that I don't have and you don't have mine. We both say them. And then we say, if what you said, Roy, is true, and if what I, Nick, said is true, then this third thing is true that neither one of us thought of. That's right. When 1 and 1 makes 3. That's when intellect advances. And for that to have happened, yes, you can't have this shut down all thought that disagrees with my mentality. You got to have a civil debate.
There's an actual conversation there, and there's an actual consideration of your perspective and my perspective and how these pieces of iron can sharpen each other.
I get smarter by debating you. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I disagree. No, I'm kidding. let me ask you this. So the whole point of this podcast at large is to, you know, this thing that I saw when we got into this game was these functions that we serve and that we're a part of, I think, are these massively underutilized assets in organizations. I think that there's a lot of backward thinking, a lot of sort of 1900 style mentalities at the folks at the top who, you know, getting back to that sort of, when's my payoff for this thing? We got to hit our quarterly numbers. That's kind of a caricature of what I'm talking about, but it's about need for a direct tie between the dollars I spend on ethics and compliance and the bottom line return that I'm looking for. So these folks end up getting viewed as cost centers. They end up getting declawed. They end up sort of getting jammed into these pigeonholes, and they're not able to like be unleashed. So part of what we're trying to do is help break that mentality to elevate these functions and turn some of those light bulbs on at the top so that those people can make the impacts to the organizations that we're talking about, right? Like if you can have an authentic culture that's based on true integrity, where people feel they can be their authentic selves, and you're going to get all this goodness that we've been talking about for the last little while. How do we break out of that old mold? How do we help the people listening to this really go to that next level and stop being viewed as a cost center, which, you know, whatever that means?
We talked about earlier, it's got to be the change at the top. The motivators for the decision makers, the leaders, has to change. It has to change from quarter to quarter, share price, dividends, to something else. And it's happening. Mm-hmm. Do you know Allison Taylor?
Yeah, she was just on this a couple of weeks ago.
Ah, fantastic. So this ties in a lot to her, what she's up to. She's corporate social responsibility and more. She's done a lot of thinking about compliance and ethics too, but it's kind of like beyond compliance. I hate that phrase, to be honest with you, because you can't go beyond compliance till you stop breaking the law.
Right.
First things first. But I've been watching some of that, and investors are now starting to say to companies, portfolio manager, head fund people are starting to say, we are going to, our portfolio over the next few years is going to change to companies who focus on things like this: people, compliance, ethics, integrity, social issues, these sorts of things. Green company. And I can't remember the guy's name, but there's a guy who writes a letter every year to all the CEOs. He's one of the biggest fund managers there is. And he wrote one recently that basically said, it's time. Corporate social responsibility, ethics, integrity, these sorts of things. All those things are going to be now a factor. And then about 100 CEOs, there's some group called the CEO group or something. It's not the name.
Yeah, yeah. But
they all said, we're going to start focusing on this. Now, I believe the fund manager, I have yet to see action from the CEOs. I think it's easy to say we're going to care. But, you know, look, any compliance professional out there wants to have more support from leadership's got to earn it. They have to communicate with leadership the benefits and advantages of what we're talking about. Compliance and ethics programs. They've got to teach them we're not a cost center, we're a revenue retention center. We're a respect retention center. And then maybe go to them with this letter from this fund manager. I wish I could remember what the name of this guy's name is, but you've got to spend more time with leadership on the big picture stuff and educate them. And, you know, there's some stuff in the book that I would slip in your training, board training, C-suite training. They're all going to give you 10, 15 minutes a year or whatever it is you're going to get, never enough. But, you know, say, here's something that I think we need to teach all the employees: a little more fundamentals about critical thinking so they make better decisions, not just for business, but for ethics and integrity and compliance. So it's a battle. I hope we keep fighting it. I hope we get better at it. I think as businesses become more efficient, more automated, there's going to be more money and more time for those to say, hey, you know what? I'm going to take some of these efficiencies that we built into our organizations and saved money. I'm going to invest it in these things because I think this is going to become more and more important to people. Compliance with the rule of law, not showing up on the front page in the newspaper. Ethics, not having a failure of integrity. And then corporate social responsibility and the things that Allison is interested in, being greener and these sorts of things. I think all the signs point to this being a long, slow slog over the next 20 years. I got to tell you, 25 years ago when I started in this business, I had no idea what a compliance officer and a compliance program was.
Right.
We've come a long way. And for those of us who've been in it since the beginning, it's frustrating because it hasn't come very far in a way.
Yeah. I get what you're saying. It's, cause it ain't to the top of the mountain yet, so to speak.
It's incremental. It's such small improvement, but you just don't give up. You know, you just keep going, you keep slogging away. If what you're working on is right for the world, following the rule of law, having integrity, behaving ethically, are you kidding me? This all makes total sense. How you get there, how much resource you, you know, it's, how relevant can you become to leadership?
And there's this new thing. So I think that's a phenomenal answer. I think I agree with pretty much all of it. I would say, so the way I kind of look at it is, like, think about when the internet first came out. like, guys were like, you know, this, I mean, you had economists, New York Times economists, well-known economists saying, this is going to do nothing more than just, like, replace the fax machine. Okay, fast forward now, it's obviously part of everybody's go-to-market strategy. It's part of their identity. It's how they do business on every single level. But there was, when that fax machine discussion was going on, the board was thinking, you know, what is this? This is stupid. We need a website. I don't even know what a server is, right? So at some point, those light bulbs went on. At some point, the critical, you know, that tipping point was hit. And, you know, what do they say? It happens, you know, an overnight success takes 20 years and then it happens overnight, or it happens little by little and then all at once. That same thing happened in IT. I think we're going to see it over this next decade in the HR and in the ethics and compliance.
Wonderful, wonderful metaphor. Let me tell you a funny little story just to prove your point. So I was in college. I had a Hort degree. I had a 2-year degree and a 4-year degree and 2.5 years of experience working in some pretty amazing greenhouses. And for the fun of it, I took 6 Fortran and basic programming languages. They were my electives. It turns out the 6 programming classes in 1980 sold for more than the 2 degrees and 2.5 years of experience in quality greenhouses. And I went to work for the University of Wisconsin. Ironically, I worked there twice, totally different industries. And I was considered a unicorn and a genius and a rare deal because I understood microcomputers. Mm-hmm. Actually, not till I got there. That's what they had me work on. So 1980-82, I developed this expertise, very short, but nobody had it, so it was really valuable. And I eventually got to work at Mayo Clinic. I think it was maybe 84, 85. And I went to work in the IT department as the first microcomputer programmer to ever work there. To be hired for that reason. There was another guy I worked for that was doing some stuff in it. They had 50 IBM PCs at the time. And the big IT guys, who were my friends, I liked the people. We worked together well, but they told me, that's a toy. Get it out of here. Okay? You cannot put computing in the hands of the end user. And they were right, and they were totally wrong. They were right from their perspectives. They wrote in assembler, COBOL, languages the average person couldn't write in. What they were wrong about is they hadn't taken the time, or they've done the critical thinking to gather the facts and watch a spreadsheet work, a word processor work, or a database manager work. And I didn't think to show them. They didn't think to look at it. I just went around and helped a few people who had a PC who were going, holy cow, this is amazing. And then eventually, the genius, the very experienced, knew much more than IT guys, saw the spreadsheet, database, and word processor and said, oh my gosh, everything's going to change. And my biggest critic, who was a friend of mine, asked for a job in our department. He went from, get this crap out of here. Can I work for you in a year? The bell went off. Okay, that was a little quicker. It took years from there for everybody to have a computer and the internet, but you're right. So I said to myself, to tie this all into a loop, I walked away. I got a job in administration. It was cool. It was a big mistake because if I stayed in the microcomputer industry, I'd have been retired by now. And with the early start and expertise and all that crap. I say, if it ever happens to me again, if I ever see something coming where the experts, not just anybody, but the IT experts told me was junk, if I ever get in something where I even think the experts are wrong, and I'm sure I'm never leaving. I'm going to jump to the middle of it. But I thought it's never going to, I'm not going to be this lucky to see this coming this early. Lo and behold, my boss makes me a compliance officer. I had no idea what it was. About 6 months in, I smack my forehead. This is going to be huge. It's happened. Nobody gets it. Everybody's telling me it's a joke. And I jumped into the middle of it, overshot my mark, you know, with the SECE. What a piece of luck that was. But when I first started out, the experts, who were the experts? The legal community. What did the legal community think of compliance? Looking, rummaging around for problems, turning over rocks, reporting problems to leadership. They thought this was not only junk and never going anywhere, but it was harmful to the organization. And frankly, many still do. Well, 25 years later, billions, I don't know, a billion, hundreds of millions, it's gotta be billions, is being spent on this. There, it doesn't look like there are any stopping it. It's just so slow, it's frustrating.
Yeah, it's so slow, but I think the line is not a straight line. It's not a linear type of a path. I think it's a parabolic path. And I think the reason why is because some of those light bulbs at the top are starting to go on because this fund manager is writing it, because these studies come out that show the ethical companies actually outperform and they actually move the needle on an indirect basis. The integration of an organization where the silos between marketing and accounting and ops and all this stuff, those things are starting to bleed out and, you know, fall away essentially. And the integrated nature of an organization, I think, is becoming more and more apparent. And what I think is going to really help it to accelerate is, again, COVID, pending depression, perhaps recession notwithstanding, is that as this generational shift takes place and as the millennials become the largest sort of contributors to the economy, the millennials who have a different sort of hierarchy of values, so to speak, it's not just the almighty dollar. It's about these other things for a number of reasons, right? They're well-educated more so than others. They come out with all this debt. They've seen two economic crashes in their lives. All these other things that people used to sort of stand on as absolute truths are not true to this whole group. There is that different priority set is feeding into consumption decisions. And now this line, I had a recent conversation that was super interesting, but this line between sort of marketing, external branding, and internal branding or employer branding is starting to bleed out to such a degree. There's so much more transparency with social. People are making decisions, especially now with the whole COVID thing, about brands based on how they treat their people. This sort of altruism and all this other stuff feeds into the decision-making at a much deeper level. And like I said earlier, we're going to see a massive separation. And this whole thing may be the catalyst that really is the true tipping point for these positions to accelerate out and them not to be viewed as this cost center, but to say, you know what, if I throw a couple extra bucks to build our employer brand, the things I care about, our bottom line, our margins, whatever, are going to increase because we're going to be more efficient. We're not going to have 20% turnover every year. And our people are going to stay 15% longer than they normally would. All those other things that are obviously dollar-based things, we're obviously, you know, I love this term you said, revenue retention centers. I'm going to spend more money on the revenue retention centers because my reputation, right, which is just the sum, you know, my brand is a reputation. The reputation is just the sum of all these activities within my organization. I'm never going to have a company or a brand that my clients love if it's not full of people that love that company. So the people that are able then to affect that culture, people who are able to affect, you know, compliance, ethics, HR, who are able to drive those behaviors within the organization, those are the folks that need to be empowered. And now I'm not going to start cutting from those folks, just like I'm not going to say, you know what, we got to shut down our data center. Time to tighten our belt. Let's shut down our website. Like, no one's going to say that because that's an integral piece of the puzzle. It's an accelerant. And that's what I think these functions actually are.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the recession or depression or whatever happens affects the compliance world, because they're going to have to be cutting and selective, and we'll know in a year or two, there'll be some numbers that we'll be able to point to that. So a couple of thoughts that I want to add to what you were saying is, A, it has to be affordable. You have to have the money and resources to be able to spend on this. And if you look at the efficiency gains from robotics, automation, mm-hmm. spreadsheets, database, word processing, the world has become wildly more efficient. Mm-hmm. A company has more resources now. They don't need 10 people in accounting, they need one. They don't need 100, they need 10. I'm not, you know, who knows what the numbers are, but the automation is, it has to have helped. So now we can afford to do this. The other thing you talked about is transparency. I call it forced transparency is a factor in all this. I have two words for you. Panama Papers. The hackers are now getting their excitement out of rummaging through data and disclosing it, not for profit, but for social issues. And so if everybody is starting to realize that nothing they say or do is safe anymore, then what they're going to say and do is more likely to be ethical and compliant than it would have been 10, 20 years ago. So it's fun. Who knows? It's to debate the future, the factors that will affect the future. I've just personally, I've been watching it for 24 years. I don't have any different view than I did the day it finally hit me what a compliance program was. And a compliance officer did. It was about 6 months after I had the job. And I had the same thought that I did when I saw a microcomputer in 1980. This is going to be huge. I thought 24 years ago, when about, it was 95 or 6, I was made a compliance officer. This is going to be huge. I have been in the middle of it, dead square center pretty much for 24 years. I've been told I'm right and I'm wrong. I've debated it with the best there is. I'd like to think I've been optimistic and playing devil's advocate and being responsible and not saying things that are hopeful and not true. I think it's still going to be a part of every everyday life. It's going to get into places that it isn't in now. A great example of that, of where there'll be growth, nonprofits. For-profit companies have been the first to be asked to implement compliance program by the government. That's where the focus has been. But as we can see, there are nonprofit gigantic entities that have been operating on the basis of trust like no other organization because their mission is good. So everybody must be honest, and all our employees must be honest. Well, they're finding out they're no different. And so now they're implementing mechanisms. Call them a compliance program, call them a doorknob. It's auditing, monitoring, education. Policies and procedures. This is going to be big.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is that's the next area for the compliance explosion to come, because there's so much sort of compliance opportunity there, and there's so much moral hazard potential there.
Their risk is their trust. Trust but verify. Trust and trust. Trust but don't verify. Is a risk area,
right?
And it's beautiful. Some of these nonprofits are doing the greatest things for people in the world, but they're at risk of poor behavior. Maybe not as much as some other industries or types of organizations, but
they're at least right
failing left and right. They're in the newspaper for epic legal and ethics failures. So why aren't they looking for, why aren't they preventing, finding, and fixing ethical and regulatory problems with a compliance and ethics program and a compliance and ethics officer more often than they do? And all this will push down into smaller and smaller companies too. There's lots of room for growth.
Last thing, I promise. What are your thoughts on this whole whistleblower thing where you have
the- don't ask me this question. The answer is going to be way too good, sir.
All right. Well, at risk of overshadowing everything we've talked about for the last little while here, it's just an interesting thing for me because I think any whistleblower, assuming they're not like a tattletale, let's put that aside because that's kind of like a silly thing. It's coming from a place of like, I think, high integrity, right? It's like there's some dissonance between how things are supposed to go and what I'm seeing. And there's some ownership I feel as a whistleblower for the culture, for the business, for the bill of goods, so to speak, that I was sold. I'm going to speak up and do something about it and say something about it. And then these guys, in many cases, they end up kind of getting screwed.
Okay. I'm a bit of a devil's advocate. I'm whistleblowing. We have a hotline. We have to teach people about the hotline. We have to ask them to call the hotline. We need issues reported. Okay. But what's not being discussed is the abuse of the hotline. Let me give you a couple examples. When hotlines first emerged onto the scene, I believe it was the French and the Germans, two European countries said, not in our country. And my fellow colleagues in the compliance industry blew a gasket and said, how can we do this? I'm a multinational. I can't have a hotline here and not there. And how could you not want this information? You must be bad people. No. They have a memory of what happened to people who blew the whistle in Germany and other countries as the Nazis went through Europe. People died as a result of whistleblowers. I'm definitely going to jail now. To relate those two terms. But essentially, what did people do? They called up, go look in this basement. Okay, is that a whistleblower? I don't know. You told on people. You want these people? Here they are. You want this problem? Here it is. People are making phone calls to people to tell them. Now, it was for evil. It was for pure evil. But
it was compliant.
They said, you want these guys? Here they are. You're telling me I got to turn these over? You're going to kill me? Here they are. I don't know. I told you I was going to get in trouble. I am definitely going to jail now. But here's the thing. I cannot be fired.
Very secure position you're in, yeah.
Here's another. So everybody sat down and said, look, guys, I understand you got this problem. You have this history. You never want to go back there. But we got to have this. How are we going to be able to work it out? What are you really concerned about? They said, I'm concerned about protecting the accused, the falsely accused, and or the inappropriately accused or whatever, because that was what was stuck in their head. Mm-hmm. I'm not really comparing them. That's what the French and Germans did. They compared this whistleblower thing to what happened to Jewish folks during the war. Okay. And so if you're mad, call somebody else. Okay, so they said, well, what if we implemented controls to protect the falsely accused? And the French and the Germans said, okay, now they got hotlines. I have been concerned about the falsely accused since day one. And secondly, I have been accused, I've been concerned about those who don't make a strong enough effort to report it internally. There are people who walk down the hallway, grab some supervisor and say, I think there's a problem over there in this department. and the supervisor's running down the hall for some other thing, and they don't follow up properly, then the individual goes to the government and says, give me my 33%. I told them and they didn't act on it. Well, how hard did you try?
Right.
What kind of effort did you make? Now, I'm not going to win any favors from people. They're going to criticize me. I'm sorry. That's not me. I'm going to die on my sword or whatever they say, fighting internally to help my company that I'm loyal to fix the problem. If I get ignored, I'm going to go up a step. If I get ignored, especially if I'm a compliance officer, and then I'm going to end up at the audit committee of the board and say, if you don't listen to me, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to write you board members, every board member, a letter saying, here's the problem. And if you don't fix it, I'm leaving. Or no, I'm leaving. That's actually the noisy exit step. The last step, hopefully, where I get to keep my job is with the audit committee. If they don't rally around me, I write the letter to the board saying, this is my noisy exit. Here's why I left. You should look into this. And then I got to decide whether I'm going to report it externally. Okay, I'm that guy. I'm not the guy who makes one little conversation for 3 minutes and then goes.
And there's a lot of that in your view of, you know, these whistleblowers who end up getting blackballed because they go to report their company to the SEC or something. Like, you're saying that if you're really loyal to your company and you're really a high integrity person, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, I'm trying to summarize the position. If you're really a high integrity person and you're really willing to sort of go to the government, then you should have already exhausted every single sort of reasonable step underneath the umbrella of your organization before you kind of talk about family business outside the family.
Okay. So here's the problem with my thinking is that there's some people who are shy or they don't have financial resources or whatever. They're truly afraid. And they quit sooner than I do for a reason that many would say is okay. Okay? I'm just saying what I would do. Mm-hmm. Before I became a whistleblower, I believe it's a matter of integrity to my obligation to the people who are paying my salary and my benefits to go in, and I'm going to fight to the death. The death will be my firing or my noisy exit with a letter to the board and out the door, whether I'm a compliance officer or not. That's where I would go. Then I walk out the door. I don't have my job anymore. Then I decide what to do. And I tell you, if people are being physically harmed, I'm going straight to the police, straight to the government. I probably would have done that sooner had I been. I'm not going to wait. Physical harm, I'm not going to wait a couple of weeks.
Yeah, it's a different category, is what you're saying. Yeah. I appreciate you coming on. This has been a phenomenal conversation. It's, you know, again, I had a feeling that we were going to be able to get at least 2 episodes out of this, and we may have gotten 3. So I just appreciate your book. I appreciate your friendship and your willingness to share your insights that you've gathered over the years and your perspective. You're a unique voice in this compliance game. And I just appreciate you spending some of your afternoon with me. I know time is tight for you now.
I have absolutely enjoyed it, sir. And I would love to think of an excuse to do something like this again. I think your perspective on this, your attitude, your by the way, very positive attitude, the people you surround yourself with, I love it, dude. And I'm glad we ran into each other. I remember you coming by the booth last year. Didn't you do that?
I did, yeah.
And Karen looked at me after, who was that guy? you're an absolute anomaly, fascinating, interesting. I haven't quite got it figured out yet, sir. All I know is it's real good. I really appreciate being able to do this. I hope we find an excuse to do some more.
Absolutely.
All right, man.
Appreciate it. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Take care.